argument this morning is Virchak against Holder. Mr. Nixon.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. We urge the Court to invalidate Title 8 CFR 1208.4A54, which is the regulation at issue in this appeal. The regulation provides that a delay, essentially provides that a person's asylum application can be considered on the merits if that person maintained a temporary protected status, other immigration status, or had parole until a reasonable period before filing the application. This is vague, Your Honor, and it should be invalidated for that.
The word reasonable certainly has some cloud around it, but it's one of the most common words in law. It is, for example, the core of all of tort law, which uses the reasonable person standard. Is it your position that all tort law is unconstitutional?
No, Your Honor. But I think that here we can do better. Here there are easier alternatives.
Well, look, the Ninth Circuit once held a federal statute unconstitutionally vague because it was possible to replace a vague term with a number. Right? And they said the standard is whether things can be improved. That's what you've just said. And the Supreme Court said reversed, 9-0. That case is U.S. against Powell, which neither side cites. But the Supreme Court held in Powell that just because you can replace a vague term with a number doesn't make the vague term unconstitutional. Your whole argument supposes that Powell came out the other way.
Your Honor, I think there are many reasons why the result here is bad. For one thing, even if we don't say that what should be done here is to replace this standard with a number.
Well, look, Congress sometimes uses numbers. In our last case, Congress actually used 180 days. If you're out of status for 180 days, you can't get a particular kind of relief. Here, the regulation uses the word reasonable. But I understand your argument to be that if you can be more precise, you must be more precise. And that, as I say, was the precise argument that the Supreme Court rejected in Powell. Now, generally, we tend to follow the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court has, in at least one decision of which I'm aware, and it was not cited in the briefs, so I thought I might file a letter about it, invalidated a reasonableness statute. That is the A.B. Small versus American Sugar Refining Company case. It's an old case from the 1920s. And in that court, in that case, there was a proscription on the sale of sugar at unreasonable or unjust prices, and the court said that this violated the Fifth Amendment. The court did distinguish a rent control case.
That sounds like Lochner. It doesn't sound like vagueness. That sounds like Lochner. Well, Lochner isn't with us anymore.
Your Honor, even if the court does not believes that the reasonableness standard here is acceptable, there's still...
Did they rely on Lochner in that case? I'll look it up in a second.
I'm not sure that they did, Your Honor. It's at 45 Supreme Court 295.
Yeah, we use the citations to the U.S. reports here.
I'm sorry, sir. It's 267 U.S. 233. And the court in that case did distinguish another decision which upheld a reasonableness standard. So I do not mean to imply that all reasonableness standards are invalid. Clearly they're not. But here it is our firm position that the guidance is insufficient.
Let me ask you a very simplistic question. If the regulation is void, is there any – we act as if it's not there, and then there would be no avenue for relief.
I don't think that's I would not agree with that, Your Honor, because there still is the statutory provision which allows for excuse of the failure to file within 1 year when there are exceptional circumstances.
Extraordinary circumstances. Is that vague? Extraordinary circumstances?
Is it vague?
Is it unconstitutionally vague?
I do not take that position, Your Honor. Our premise is that because the agency here endeavored in a regulation to fill in the gaps in that statute, I don't say whether that statute is, I suppose we would not say whether that statute is vague or not, but because Congress because the agency undertook it to provide content, it should and could have done a better job. If Mr. Virilgisak had been found by the board to have filed within a reasonable period, it would be impossible under this regulation to say that the result was unjustified. It would be impossible to say 9.5 months here was not reasonable. We would have, of course, there would be no court challenge in that instance. But the point that I make is this is the equal protection aspect of the appeal, which can exist independently of invalidation on fair notice grounds. The court can say that this regulation violates equal protection because it enables the same conduct to be classified in different ways.
That argument is troubling because, among other things, of all the kinds of issues we review, district judges' decisions for abuse of discretion, and a finding that a district judge has not abused discretion is often perfectly consistent with a decision that somebody who decided the same issue the other way also did not abuse discretion. Does that whole area or method of legal decision-making violate the Equal Protection Clause?
I don't think it necessarily would, Your Honor. And I'm sorry that I can't be more satisfactory in my response to your question, which I think is also implicated somewhat by Judge, or is similar to Judge Chief Judge Easterbrook's question. The reason why is that the due process laws are so vast and situations are so different. It seems to me that the Supreme Court provides more due process rights in one instance than it does in another based on the character of the sort of decision that is being made. Here, I feel that the decision is amenable to more content, maybe not a number, but more explanation from the agency with regard to the factors that should be considered.
With the regulation be cured in your mind if the BIA had published a few more opinions interpreting it?
Possibly it could, but I would have to see what it was that they would say. I think they've said very little in their one published decision. They've restated some of the guidance in the Federal Register notice.
That 6 months would usually not be reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor. And there, of course, there's also language in Federal Register notice that says generally where exceptional and changed circumstances are concerned, a year is no good, but there may be rare cases in which a delay of over a year may be okay.
Is that discretion unconstitutional?
If it is unfettered, I believe, yes, it is. Where we can say that the same facts are coming out, or very similar facts are being decided differently, there's too much room there for a judge to make determinations based on personal predilections and not on factors before him. I'm into my rebuttal time.
Does it follow, therefore, that the Supreme Court's decision in Apprendi and Booker violate the Constitution? Right? That sentencing guidelines set up rules for how you're supposed to impose sentences, and the Supreme Court said that that was unconstitutional and district judges had to have discretion. And now it sounds like you're saying that only rules are constitutional and discretion is unconstitutional.
Your Honor, I would not say that Apprendi, I could not say that Apprendi was unconstitutional, only that
the Supreme Court said that under the Constitution, sentencing judges have to have essentially unlimited discretion, with no standards at all other than their own sense of what's appropriate.
I would think that the determination of a sentence involves factors that are wholly different from those here. For that reason, the situation is inapposite.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Jones.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Juria Jones, representing the Attorney General of the United States. This Court should dismiss the petition for review for lack of jurisdiction for one reason. Excuse me. The petitioner has failed to set forth a cognizable constitutional claim to restore this Court's jurisdiction. Specifically, this Court should pierce through petitioner's void for vagueness argument and really see it for what it is. It's a disagreement with the discretionary determination made by the agency. And this Court should also reject the equal protection arguments for similar reasons.
Could I just ask you this? Would you concede that although we need not address the issues that were raised by amicus, we may address them in our discretion?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I would concede that.
Because I'm very curious about this regulation that the amicus discusses that requires the immigration judge to reconsider asylum when withholding of removal has been granted, and why that regulation wasn't employed in that, you know, in this case. And I'm referring to 8 CFR section 12.08.16.
Correct. And you're asking why that wasn't employed in this case?
Yeah.
Because in this particular case, that regulation, and excuse me if I misspeak, I actually will make sure I correct the Court, but that regulation deals with when you have a timely asylum application denied on credibility determinations, and when it's overruled that the determination is the credibility is actually credible, then you should relook at the asylum. Here's not the case. We have an untimely asylum application. The Congress enacted 8 U.S.C. 1158A2 to specifically say that you have a one-year deadline from the date of entry to file your application. And at 8 U.S.C. 1158A2D, Congress said that an application for asylum may be considered if the alien demonstrates to the satisfaction of the Attorney General extraordinary circumstances relating to the delay in filing that application within 1 year. So,
Does the record tell us anything about typical reasonable delays? Do we know the longest period of time that an immigration judge has found reasonable, or the shortest period of time not found reasonable?
I do not know, Your Honor. I would have to sort of do a sort of a vast survey of all the immigration judge's decision to determine reasonableness. But that kind of goes to the core of what we're talking about. It's a discretionary determination that this Court lacks jurisdiction to review under 8 U.S.C. 1158A3. That statute specifically says that no court shall have jurisdiction to review any determination made under the paragraph that I cited previously. So the fact of the matter is, whether or not an immigration judge or the board or the agency decides what's reasonable is without, this Court is without jurisdiction to review. The jurisdiction is restored by the Real ID Act under 8 U.S.C. 1252A2D by if a petitioner brought a pure question of law or a constitutional issue. That's exactly what we're talking about here. That's not the case. This is not a constitutional issue. Petitioner is trying to sort of shoehorn a discretionary determination into constitutional law terms, and this Court is without jurisdiction to review once it peels back and looks at exactly what petitioner is trying to do.
Ms. Jones, can I just ask you what's at stake here since the BIA has ordered withholding of removal?
What's at stake from our perspective or from petitioner's perspective?
I'll take either one.
Well, what's at stake from our perspective, we obviously don't want you to say that the regulation is void for vagueness.
Okay.
And we obviously don't
I understand
want you,
that position.
Right. From but, his perspective, again, this is a lot of speculation, but he's assuming that if this Court decides that the regulation is void, this Court would then have to sort of look at the statute and say that the statute itself is void. He's assuming then that the agency will determine that his application is reasonable, but that, again, goes to the core of what we're saying here. That's a factual determination.
I understand that, but he's not going anywhere soon, I gather.
He's not withholding a removal, so
yeah.
No.
But can he go back, visit his family, and come back again?
He doesn't have the same privileges under,
right.
as an asylum.
Answer is no. He can't go back.
No, exactly. That's what
he has to just sit tight here.
Because he did not file his application. Congress dictated that application.
In other words, he can never travel anywhere in this world.
Well, I wouldn't.
And come back.
I wouldn't go. I mean, Your Honor, I wouldn't go that far and say never. Again, I would have to go back and look at the particulars of this.
Presumably, he would need a grant of
advance
parole.
Exactly. So I would. You'd have to go back and look at the particulars of this case and figure out his relationship with United States Citizen and Immigration Services, with the Department of Homeland Security, with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. I can't make that claim that he never could do that, but you're right, there is a distinction between what an asylum seeker who is granted asylum gets versus a withholding of removal. But Congress dictated that there's a one-year deadline. Congress is the one that decided that you have 1 year from the date of entry to file your application. Congress is the one that statutorily granted the AG discretion to say, look, beyond that 1 year, the agency may consider these applications under if this alien provides extraordinary circumstances. But Congress, in the same breath, said that that determination is unreviewable by this court. So you can't cloak this into a constitutional claim and try to masquerade it as such when, in reality, what he's asking for is the court to review the reasonableness of the agency's decision.
I ask you about one corner of the constitutional problem. You've argued in your brief that the petitioner does not have a protected liberty interest here. I have trouble reconciling that position with our case in Kazmierczak and other cases that followed, which were not addressed in your brief.
You're asking me to address that. What we're saying and what are the arguments that we repeatedly make throughout all the circuit courts is that he doesn't have a statutorily protected right to file an untimely asylum application. There is no protected right here, so there is no triggering of a constitutional analysis here. The fact of the matter is his asylum application is untimely filed. He concedes that.
I understand your position. I'd ask you, but how can you address how we could agree with you on that without overruling Kazmierczak?
I would suggest that perhaps I could probably file a post-argument memo that would be able to explore that further. Like you said, it wasn't cited in our briefs. We didn't go to that analysis a little bit further. And I would want to be able to look at particularly the facts of those particular cases to be able to make sure that my distinction is correct.
We'd be happy to have the parties file letter memoranda within 7 days addressing Kazmierczak.
Thank you, Your Honor. One other last argument I'd like to talk about is his equal protection argument that he makes. And particularly, I think that's what he's falling back on. When you peel back and see what he's actually arguing, he's saying the board's regulation should have, could have, would have said this. It treats people differently. And petitioner cites in his opening brief Del Marcel versus Brown Country Corporation. And what's particularly enlightening is the dicta that's in that per curiam decision. And then within the dicta, the court talked about that's not a good sign.
It is very difficult to rely on anything in that case since there is no majority opinion.
That is true, Your Honor.
Plurality opinion is a dissent.
That is correct, Your Honor. However, that's why I was very particular saying that it was the dicta I was referring to, and it's enlightening, not persuasive.
The dicta in a set of opinions, none of which is authoritative anyway.
I didn't say it was persuasive. I said it was enlightening. That's the word I was trying to go at. And in particular, because it was talking
We're
about...
We're open to that kind of an argument.
It was talking about the different treatment that can be made by one asylum officer or another, and the fact of the matter that random can be rational. Here, this court has said repeatedly, just because, and also in Fitzgerald versus Johnson and Thomas versus Chicago Park, that a regulation that allows for discretion doesn't render the regulation unconstitutional. If this court doesn't have any other questions, I'd rest on the brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel.
Two reasonable attorneys today.
Mr. Nixon, anything further?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.